Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadist for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi. I'm the author of The Atheist Muslim, A Journey from Religion to Reason. And with me is Armin Navabi, the founder of the enormous Atheist Republic, and also the author of Why There Is No God. Good evening, Armin. Hope you're well.
Hello.
And there is a very important day. Today, as we record this, we're just a couple of days away from December 25th, which is a momentous day because it is Armin's birthday.
Oh,
that is the main reason. And then on a minor point, it's also Christmas. But we'll get into that.
So I only managed to get you and my wife so far to care about my birthday more than Jesus's birthday. So that's two down, another 2 billion people to go.
We'll get there. Yeah. So today, actually, on the show, we have Drew McCoy, who many of you know as a genetically modified skeptic on YouTube, and Drew actually started his YouTube channel around early 2017, March 2017, and by the end of the year, he had 10,000 subscribers, and as of the beginning of this month, he has hit 100,000 subscribers, YouTube subscribers, and I've been hearing about his videos, and they're popping up all over the place. He's got millions of views. Everything he does is just super insightful, thought-provoking, really compassionate. I mean, that's another thing for an atheist YouTuber. I mean, you don't see that a whole lot, but he's very nuanced, he's very thoughtful, he's very compassionate. And inspiring. So we're going to get into a lot of things today. But first of all, welcome, Drew, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's not every day you get to be on your favorite podcast. I mean, unless you guys, you know, your favorite podcast is your own, which that might be a little egotistical, but, you know, but yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you. The honor is all ours. I mean, I've been just watching your stuff for the last two or three days. I've just really, really, you've got so many good videos, and I have so many different things I want to talk about, but I know that we're probably not going to be able to get to it all today. But let's start with just you. I mean, you started this YouTube channel in early 2017. You come from a Christian background, so can you tell us how this happened? How did you become a genetically modified skeptic?
Yeah, so I was raised Christian fundamentalist. I was independent fundamental Baptist. It's kind of funny because I just had Vidu Vids and Mimsy Vids, Zara K, all on my channel, and we kind of compared and contrasted some of the things that were a little bit more fundamental about what we believed, and we had a whole lot in common, yeah. Except Vidu told me that he could dance and I couldn't, and so he had that up on me. I was raised that way. I believed all of it. I wasn't one of these people that was young and kind of like questioning it, like, oh, maybe this is true. No, I totally bought it until, you know, adulthood. And I was also in college kind of surrounded by people who sold certain types of alternative medicine, specifically essential oils. And that was a big part of becoming a skeptic for me. Basically, long story short, I became kind of an agnostic right after I graduated from college, or around the time I graduated from college, which was in 2015. And like end of 2015. And then by kind of the beginning of 2016, I realized, you know, I'm an atheist, and I called myself an agnostic atheist. And eventually I realized that I needed to get some of my ideas out there and thought I could have a positive impact and have a good time doing it. So I decided to start a channel about a year into being an atheist or so.
What was it in college that made you go agnostic? You're saying that you became agnostic shortly after you finished college, but what did you study? Was there anything you studied there? How did that come about?
Well, I didn't become an agnostic or just non-religious in general for the lack of my colleges trying to keep me a fundamentalist Christian. I went to a very Christian university and we had to go to chapel 3 times a week. And, you know, I also went to church. So I was in some kind of church service about 4 or 5 times a week, plus a devotional starting out every single class. So I had some kind of thing going on every single day, multiple times a day. And I was a young earth creationist. That's an important detail. And
so you believe that the earth was like 6,000 years old or?
Yeah. And obviously didn't believe in evolution and didn't believe in, I was an old earth creationist. The universe was only 6,000 years old. I thought that I could date it almost like to pretty much a decade. I thought that's how accurately we could date it. And it was like something like 6,120 years or something like that. And eventually I ended up taking, I think it was my sophomore year, I took an astronomy class that taught me about mainly the origins of light. And I wrote a paper on the origins of light in that class. And essentially it was my own proof to myself. And the teacher agreed on it because I got a 95 on the paper. The origins of light do disprove a young universe. Yes, there. It's very well established that it's about 13.8 plus billion years that light has existed in the universe or so. And it would take over 10,000 years just for a single photon to escape the fusion reaction in the core of the sun and then get out just to the surface of the sun. So even for photons to leave the sun, it takes longer than young earth creationists think that the universe is.
What's interesting is that in Genesis in the Bible, it talks about how everything was created and then on a later day, it was actually later on that God said, let there be light. There was light. So he created everything else in the dark before light came around. So,
well, there's light and then there's a bunch of stuff and then the stars. And so it's like, where did the stars come from? You mean there were plants before the sun existed? That doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Well, there were days before the sun existed. Like, this is a day before the earth.
Guys, trying to make sense of God. You're not supposed to understand. You're just mere mortals, right? So this is not supposed to be. Anyways, but so if you're an ex-Christian, right? So but one thing that got a lot of ex-Muslims interested in your channel was the fact that you didn't pull any punches against Islam. I know a lot of people that came out of other religions, they, when it comes to Islam, they just dance around it, either with the excuse that this is not my background, or this is something that I don't think I should be talking about. It's not my experience. But you decided that, no, this is something I'm going to cover. And you have some really, really good videos addressing some Islam related topics. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I was raised Protestant and I was young earth creationist, and no one criticizes me for arguing against Catholics, even though we consider that a completely different religion, which was a false religion, and they were all, you know, deceived by the devil, by the shaitan, right? And I was totally allowed to argue against that, and because it's a European religion, is what it seemed to me. And then when I started learning about Islam, and I knew a little bit about it when I was a Christian, and when I became an atheist, I wasn't scared of the Quran anymore. Like, I was literally afraid of the Quran growing up. I was told that, you know, basically jinn possession would happen, like demon possession could happen. They'd come right out, like fly out of the pages and corrupt your mind.
As a Christian, you were told that if you read the Quran, that you could get possessed by demons?
You are susceptible to demonic influence at the very least. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I was also told that you had to wash, like all Muslims all believe that you had to wash your entire body from head to toe and exfoliate your skin. And like, even it would like hurt, and to even be able to look at the Quran that you owned. And I was like,
only if you're a Kardashian. That's it.
Otherwise, no. But yeah, so I was taught all these kind of crazy things about Islam. And then I started learning about it when I became an atheist. And I was like, you know what? the arguments, the apologetics. I mean, a lot of the apologetics that I was taught, like the Kalam cosmological argument, these were all thought up by Muslims. A lot of the arguments are literally the same thing. And then they just take it to Islam rather than, or to the Quran rather than to the Bible or something. And yeah. So the arguments are super similar. And a lot of just the thought processes, like the post hoc rationalizations, the scientific miracles, the interpretation craziness that goes on, they're the same arguments as are used in Christianity. So why is it any different that I criticize Islam if I you know, do my best to try to understand it well, than criticizing a completely different denomination of Christianity? I don't see how there's a difference there if it's talking about ideas.
So did you tackle it because you were told, because you thought that this is something that people are saying you shouldn't be tackling, and you were like, fuck that, I'm going to tackle it specifically because people are telling me that they shouldn't be tackling it? Is that part of your motivation?
I think originally it was just, well, it's just fair enough. Mm. I mean, I'll criticize whatever religion, and it doesn't matter. It's just fair game. Whatever religion it is, I'll criticize it. However, I criticize Islam, I think, and have a little bit more of an emphasis on it these days, because I think that there's a larger human rights crisis that involves Islam than anything that involves Christianity at the moment, even though Christianity, you know, has problems, obviously. But one of the reasons why I say, fuck that, I'm gonna do this and kind of charge toward it, yeah, is partly because people say now, and it's not because, like, they're like, oh, atheists can't do this, or ex-Christians can't criticize this. It's like, so many people get accused of bigotry. I mean, like Yasmin Muhammad gets accused of bigotry against Muslims, or like racism against Arabs for criticizing Islam. And I'm like, no, that's a completely terrible and toxic, destructive attitude to have. So that's why I'm like, fuck that, I'm going to do this, because that's as nearly as toxic of an idea as Islam itself in many ways, because Islam says, no, you're not allowed to criticize this. No, you're not allowed to do this. This is sacred. This is sacred. If you say, no, you can't criticize Islam, you can't do this, you can't ever talk about how maybe a minority in your country is wrong about their ideas, yeah, that's holding to like a religious standard. It's making something sacred that shouldn't be held sacred. And as long as you can actually be compassionate where people deserve compassion, then the ideas are completely fair game as far as I'm concerned.
So yeah. Let me just ask one thing. I want to move into one of the videos that you have, because this is related. It's a fantastic video. It's called Four Liberal Defenses of Islam Debunked. And in that, you know, you go into the whole Sam Harris, Ben Affleck, Bill Maher the thing that happened in 2014, and you kind of go into why liberals should be able to criticize Islam. And this is kind of interesting, because there's a polarization here. Like, people on the right, people conservative, tend to, like, okay, here's what happens to me. Whenever, if I say anything about Christianity, then everybody on the right comes up. It's like, well, you know, why are you criticizing Christianity? You know, nobody's chopping heads off. What about Islam? And then if I criticize anything about Islam, then, you know, people on the left come up and they say, well, what about Christianity? And why are you criticizing Islam? You know, Christianity was so bad. It was like ISIS, you know, in Europe, and you know, a couple of centuries ago, and so on. So, you know, I agree with you. It's completely hypocritical. I mean, if we're just talking about ideas, they're both very similar when it comes to criticizing the idea of faith and the idea of myth and falsehood, and even how dangerous they are. But how do you... do you ever find yourself caught between this whole left-right liberal-conservative struggle, and which way do you lean? What do you align with, if anything?
Yeah, so I definitely get caught in the middle, although I think that people think that I align differently than I do. I mean, that's just the nature of having a certain critical mass of people see a video. When I released the video that you mentioned there, I was called, let me see if I can think of all this, a fascist, alt-right, a racist, a conservative, a Trumper, all this kind of stuff. And I was also called a communist, Antifa, far left, a liberal snowflake, a progressive, a regressive, all in the same video. Like, all in the same video comment section, probably within 12 hours.
Yeah, not surprising.
Any mention of you being a white man?
Oh, yeah. I've actually gotten a lot of private messages that I remember. One, my favorite one was, keep your male opinion out of it. Because I talked about hijab and I thought that was hilarious. And then I was just like, I'm curious about this. And we went down the rabbit hole just a little bit. And it turned out that the person said, yes, you know, there are women in Islam that are oppressed because they couldn't deny things happening in Saudi Arabia or things happening in Pakistan or even certain parts of India or whatever. They couldn't deny that bad things were happening. They disagreed with because they were like a Muslim feminist. And I was like, yeah, so those are bad. And I'm talking about in at least one way, like, yeah, those things are bad. What they're doing is bad. And the person ends up saying, but that's not representative of Islam. It's not worth talking about because it's only the populations of this and this. I'm like, that's the population of the entire United States easily. Mm. Like, we're talking about like 300 million people are suffering at the hand of this. And you're like, ah, it's not worth talking about. No big deal.
So. Yeah, and I always don't understand. So should men be part of the solution or keep their opinions out of it? Because you can't have both.
That's what I asked. And essentially it was, you can be part of the solution, but you can only play a support role. Yeah, you can't lead any part of the conversation.
But when it comes to the women's issues, especially with religion, it's really interesting because they talk about, you know, anytime you talk about hijab or burqa or whatever, people say that you're mansplaining, but that the entire religion is mansplaining. Like, these were concepts. These are practices that were invented by men. So, you know, the in Islam, for instance, you know, you have a male prophet. In the Quran, the tone that, you know, that is used is as if God is a male. You know, he speaks to women.
But Ali, even if Islam was a religion with both male and female leaders equally,
I agree.
It would still be bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, completely. I agree with you. I'm just adding on to what you guys were saying. So
yeah, they're being hypocritical. Like, keep your male opinion out of it, and at the same time, they have Muhammad and the imams and the khalifas.
Usually what I say, I'm like, so what you want to do is you want to accept the mansplaining of 7th century men in the Arabian desert, but you want to reject the mansplaining of 21st century men who are actually, many of them are sympathetic to feminism, and they were raised with the feminist revolution. Rightly so, and you want to reject that. So it's not about rejecting mansplaining. It's just I'm going to take this mansplaining over that mansplaining.
Do they also mention that you're white when you criticize Islam? Do they remind you about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are more likely to say, "Oh, you're racist," than say, like, "You're racist because you're white." Mm. When I talk about this stuff, and I actually get called, I have people saying, oh, you're forgetting about this part of the issue or this or that, more than I get called names, which I guess is a step in the right direction. Good. It's closer to being a good conversation. But yeah, I mean, people say, oh, you're white. You know, you grew up in Texas. You've never been outside of the United States or something, which is not true. You never met a Muslim. You never done this. And yes, that because you're raised Christian and because you're white, like, you can't talk about this. And one of the things that the place you have to go is, you know, that they're like white Muslims that have been raised in the United States and have lived their entire lives in the United States, you know, and they're allowed to be accepting of Islam and say Islam is a great idea. It's awesome. I love it. But the same people in the same situation, even if they have a similar level of education on Islam, then they're like, I'm not allowed to talk about it because I don't accept it. You're only allowed to say nice things about it.
Yeah, I mean, if tomorrow you said the Shahada and you turn Muslim, there's not going to be that Muslim complaining about, like, no, you don't understand because you're white. They would be accepting you with open arms. But do you consider it racist and sexist when people keep mentioning your sex and race when it comes to the ideas that you're trying to criticize?
When things are stupid and irrational, I usually don't go super far into categorizing it. I think it's stupid and irrational. I do find it's kind of like a counter racism or counter sexism. You know, people have said like reverse racism and that.
But
kind
isn't
of thing,
but isn't reverse racism just racism?
Just racism. Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Right. I mean, it is essentially bigotry if you're just completely excluding somebody from the conversation based in no way on their merit. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. And now it's like, I can say, oh yeah, I'm not oppressed by these people who are saying this. Like I can, right. I could say like, fuck off to these people and keep going. But yeah, it's still, if they got great enough power, then it would be oppressive to me if they had their ideas in that place of but power. So
this is what people say when you say, well, I'm not oppressed by these people. Whenever you give examples of racism to people, some people bring up worse examples of racism. And like, yeah, but yeah, I understand that some people experience worse kind of racism, but that doesn't mean that this is not racism, right?
Like, I totally agree.
Yeah. And what would you say to the criticism that people say attacking, where are you, by the way? Are you in the US or in the UK?
Yeah, I'm in the US. Texas, so, yeah.
Still in, okay. So,
I'm going there next. Anyway, we'll talk about that
offline. So when you criticize Islam, do you get the feedback that, look, in where you are and given your audience and the political climate that we're dealing with right now, Muslims are being oppressed, Muslims are a minority, they're being discriminated against, and attacking Islam, even if you don't mean to be attacking Muslims, is like feeding into the narrative of the people that are being bigots. And you're basically helping their cause and adding to that, and you're helping more people hate Muslims. And why don't you just not attack Islam right now? Maybe just attack religion as a whole. Why do you have to go after it? How would you respond to that?
Well, I get that all the time. And I get if someone has seen just part of one of my videos, you know, they might say that. Because in the United States and in plenty of Western countries, there are issues where people don't separate Islam and Muslims and are bigoted against Muslims. Like there's no denying that it happens, right? And that's not okay. It's bigotry and we need to fight against that. But if you watch my videos, and if you look at even like the demographics, like in my demographics of people who click on the videos about Islam, I think that I'm doing just as much to fight, or maybe more than some people, to fight bigotry against Muslims, because my videos about criticizing Islam are a Trojan horse for pro compassion toward Muslims and pro equality and acceptance rhetoric. I mean, I have a video that's called Muslim Feminist Accidentally Discredits Islam. Now, I got so many, I mean, that video has like nearly 300,000 views, I think.
Yeah,
and I got so many like right wing comments on it. And people like, oh, you know, this like Muslim pig and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, you guys can fuck off. But they come in and they're like, oh yeah, we're going to see this. I'm not a feminist and I'm against feminism. I'm not a Muslim and I'm against Islam. So this is going to be great. You know, Ben Shapiro destroys Muslim. Like that's what they're expecting. But instead, the very first thing that I end up saying is, even though I strongly disagree with everything that she has to say, she deserves the right to be able to speak her mind how she wants to, and she deserves the dignity and respect that we would afford any other person. If you're calling her inhuman names, basically get off my channel. That's not okay. Obviously, I don't censor people or something like that. I mean, there's been really, really horrible like death threats that I've deleted, but I mean, they click on this thing to see like something that affirms the kind of a racist narrative. And then they see somebody criticizing Islam while saying, no, like this person is a person and deserves respect, while I can criticize their ideas and still love and respect and be compassionate toward them.
But so do you think those caveats, how important are they, especially nowadays with the whole, you know, you said that, you know, people called you a Trumper. So now that, you know, you've got this, a lot of this sort of anti-Muslim sentiment, especially in the Western, then you've got this far-right populism, you've got that all the migration crisis in Europe, all this stuff's happening, and there's a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment going around. So do you feel that it's more important to make that distinction between criticizing Islam and criticizing anti-Muslim bigotry. Now, do you feel more of a pressure to caveat your videos about Islam with that compared to your videos about Christianity?
Well, there's two responses to that. And one is that it depends on the audience. If all of those things are established within the audience already, like if I'm speaking to people on my Discord or I'm doing a stream that has a smaller audience or something like that, then not so much. I mean, that's not something like I did a 100,000 subscriber live stream, and I knew that people weren't going to make it several hours into the video and probably not be like core fans. And so I didn't feel the need to say that when we were criticizing Islam, when I had some ex-Muslims on. Now, the second response to that is, when I'm making those videos, I don't see those as caveats. So what, a lot of the comments I get are like, oh, I wish you didn't have to say that. You shouldn't have to say that, all that kind of stuff. But the reality of the situation is that people click on a lot of those videos because they want to like hate Muslims, or they want to see Muslims destroyed and laugh. And
you're right.
And so one of the main goals of those videos is to separate those two things, because I don't see those as caveats. They're like a secondary goal to the entire thing. I want to criticize Islam, but to be able to even get there, I'm going to need to establish that Islam and Muslims are two different things, and this is how we can criticize them. So those videos are pretty much just as much about that than criticizing Islam. Just one is a little bit more on the face of the whole thing, and the other one is kind of hidden in like this Trojan horse.
But do you do you really want them to get off your channel or fuck off, given that they are also people that we could change their opinions on certain
things? No, and I say that because it's like oh, those ideas can fuck off, not like the people, you know. It's right. Just kind of a phrase. No, they're welcome to be on the channel, and I would want people who disagree with me to watch my videos more than people who agree with me.
Right,
and you're gonna attract people who already agree with you. Cool. That will help you build your core audience and help you like stay financially stable, I guess. But people that disagree with you, that's really your target audience, right? So no, I want those people to come on the videos, and I don't stop making the videos just because it attracts people that have like toxic or bigoted attitudes toward Muslims, because I want to change their minds about that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I do want to attract those people to our channel, because what I tell you that is, we notice a lot of them have changed their tone. Right. Yeah. A lot of them, you know, we noticed that people that joined in a long time ago and used to leave comments like, just nuke the entire Middle East. Right. They used to say, and now they're saying, well, I'm against Islam, but not against Muslims. Like a couple of years. So this is like the same people. Like, are now changing. Like, so it changes, like this do happen.
Yeah.
But
I wanted to add a comment to that. I think that one of the reasons that they have changed their tune and they've done it is because we also make that distinction here, right? We the same thing that you're saying, that, you know, we're calling it a caveat, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. Making those sort of disclaimers before, or talking about both of those issues directly, the criticizing Islam versus, you know, opposing anti-Muslim bigotry. When you do both, I mean, that is what often helps people change the way that they think about things. Now, of course, there are also a lot of anti-Muslim bigots who have picked up superficially that line, no, I'm against Islam, not against Muslims, even though they are clearly like anti-Muslim bigots too. So the whole thing is, the whole landscape is still very confusing, but I think at least it's a little bit of progress if that distinction is something that is getting more widespread attention than it used to before.
Here's another thing, though. But do you think that it do we have, like, the people that don't choose to do this? Like, for example, a lot of people say, yes, anti-Muslim bigotry is a problem, but is on a global scale, Islam is a much bigger problem than anti-Muslim bigotry, right? And you could focus on whatever you want, right? Like, people say you could focus on Christianity. Nobody should be able to tell you that, hey, why are you not attacking Islam? Maybe I don't fucking want to. I want to focus on shitting on Christianity, right? Somebody could be like focusing on tackling anti-Muslim bigotry because that's what they want to address. That's the problem that they want to focus on. And somebody might just want to decide to only focus on Islam and not address anti-Muslim bigotry. But one thing I would say, though, is like, attacking anti-Muslim bigotry actually does help your anti-Islam battle, right? Because more people take you seriously. So even though Islam is a way bigger problem than anti-Muslim bigotry as of right now, but your anti-Islam work would be way more effective if you do also have fighting against anti-Muslim bigotry. So
Yeah, you have to know the audience. You have to know the landscape of the issue at the moment. And yeah, I mean, like, I think both of them are problems. And yeah, I do think that Islam is likely a much bigger problem than that. I mean, ex-Muslim bigotry is bad, but there are fewer people being physical assaults and bullying, harassment and things like that obviously do happen. There was that video of the Syrian refugee boy being bullied in the UK recently, and I think Majid Nawaz reached out to him. Yeah, those things are really terrible, don't get me wrong, but they're not chopping that boy's head off, and there are probably nearly as many Wahhabis out there as anti-Muslim bigots. And so, yeah, that needs to be addressed. So, yeah, at the moment, you're right, Armin. It does help me address Islam itself. And I don't think that anyone is obligated to address this problem or another. If you want to address one but not the other, you can. That's okay. I mean, like, I can't tell you how to go and active in your activism. You have to choose that and let your kind of passion lead where you want it to. But yeah, for me, this is the most effective formula, especially because in the video we mentioned earlier for liberal arguments for or defense of Islam debunked, I'm a liberal myself, and most of my audience are also liberals, and I've seen those defenses in my own audience. And so I know that I already have already established, yeah, like I'm a liberal. People call me a soy boy all the time, so I must look like one. And I can probably discuss with liberals about why liberals are wrong, and they'll be more likely to take it seriously than if a conservative maybe does. And so that's the reason why I direct my attention in that way, because I think that I'm in just the right niche to be able to actually change minds.
I was actually going to say exactly what you just said. I'm like, I get the same thing, the soy boy and the liberal snowflake and everything, and it's great. I welcome it. I embrace it. But it's but that's exactly the reason. I think that if I the one thing that liberals are very conscious of, and most of my audience is liberal, most of my friends are liberal, and they're very conscious of the whole bigotry aspect. They don't want to come across as bigots, right? So when I talk about it, I address both of those things. And the reason I do is because if I just do one, then I'll get a lot of right-wing and conservative people liking it. And then I'm in an echo chamber. And yeah, It's great. I could probably double my Twitter followers and, you know, all that stuff by going down that rabbit hole. But I don't just want to make a point. I want to make a change. I actually want to reach out and talk to people who see, you know, what's going on there. Like, okay, yeah, this guy's a liberal, but, you know, okay, so he criticizes Islam too. Well, why is that? And it has been very effective. Because, you know, I want to try it and change the mind to talk to the people that I'm aligned with. Yeah, that's my issue. And that doesn't mean I want to alienate everybody else. It just, that's just the way that I choose to do things. But I have a lot of respect for people who don't. Like, there's many people who don't do that. And I totally get that too.
You know what I'm noticing that is actually even getting is I don't know if this was always like this or it's just more recent. You know how big of a problem we thought is to attack Islam without being, and people think that you're a bigot and you're a racist, calling you Nazi or whatever, and be like, oh, that's ridiculous. This is actually even worse when it comes to Judaism. And it doesn't help that the words for the religion and the ethnicity of the people is the same word.
Well, that's what's so brilliant about it, actually.
Right.
I don't think you think that was accidental. It wasn't accidental.
It was not accidental. I mean, it is accidental because throughout history, before Islam and Christianity, religions were for a certain ethnicity. Every religion was for a certain nation and for a certain certain group, right? So Judaism, being from that era, has kept that feature. So it wasn't, but it ended up being a very useful feature because now anybody attacking it all of a sudden is an anti-Semite. But you can't even touch this thing without being called an anti-Semite. And being anti, right now, being considered an anti-Semite is even more toxic than being an anti-Muslim bigot, right? So this is now, I'm trying to see how can I touch this thing and if it's possible or is everything going to be demonetized and removed and you're going to lose your entire activism because you're touching Judaism as a religion. The we the way that it was easier before to get away with it was by not calling it Judaism, but just saying the Old Testament, right? Just because people are like, well, that's just part of Christianity, right? But if you specifically say that you're shitting on Judaism as a religion, you're going to get into some serious trouble. How do you have you experienced that? Are you planning on doing something about Judaism? Whatever.
It's actually kind of funny. When I made this video we've been talking about, I got at least 100 comments within the first maybe 24 to 48 hours that told me, oh, basically you're too much of a bitch to address Judaism, I bet.
Right.
You'll shit on this because you're bigoted against them, but you would never go against Judaism, which is just as bad, or something like that, or saying, oh, you would never touch this. You think that you're so edgy, don't you? Well, I'm edgier. I'll do this. And it was so weird. Like it didn't seem to come up organically at all when people brought it up. But I'm an equal opportunity critic. And it's something that I would criticize. Now, I've seen people criticize Hasidic Jews and not run into much trouble. But if you talk about Judaism as a whole, yeah, that's pretty much exactly what happens. And when you do YouTube full time, like I do, it's not a comfortable place to be to do that. I mean, I don't know if you guys know about the whole, the latest PewDiePie controversy where he said that he liked an anime review video. He's like, oh yeah, this is a good video. He talks about Death Note, which like is insanely popular. Mm-hmm. And there was
only anime I ever watched. Actually, yeah. No. Titans is go on.
Yeah, I'm totally lost.
But. That and One Punch Man, those are the three normie animes, right? So basically, yeah, it had some little clip that PewDiePie didn't even know had anything to do with like Nazis or something like that, and it was this stupid edgy joke that most people wouldn't even get. Yeah. And now, like Vox and I think I don't know Wall Street Journal again maybe is saying, oh, he's an anti-Semite and he's horrible and he's shepherding all his audience. And I'm like, this is insane. It's ridiculous. Like this guilt by association and this like picking at these little details. They knew more about what PewDiePie had in his head than PewDiePie ever did.
But this, so, yeah, this was it would great be though.
Really bad for me if I did that. But I don't know. Maybe I will get to that at some point if I have the motivation to do so.
But this is, I think, great. So the reason why I think this is great is because, you know, a lot of people, they used to think that people that talk about Islam are probably anti-Muslim bigots. I think over the past few years, we have made a lot of progress to at least a lot of people to show that that's not the case, right? We're just arguing against religions like we do against any other bad idea, right? But we haven't, now because of the rise of, I mean, more apparent, I think anti-Semitism was always there, but people are becoming more daring and a lot of people, it's becoming more popular again. This is a new sensitive topic, right? And I think people are not, the progress that we have made, even the small progress that we have made with Islam, this is the progress that we haven't made, that you can criticize Judaism as a religion without being an anti-Semite. But I think attacking PewDiePie in such an obviously ridiculous way, I think helped because he has such a huge audience, right?
Yeah.
And he showed the whole world how ridiculous these people are being. And I think that helped us. I think PewDiePie helped all of us a lot by showing how ridiculous these accusations are. And I think because of PewDiePie, we just made years worth of progress in just the last week, I think. Because it was so obviously ridiculous.
Watch out. Do you want a Vox article written about you, Armin?
No, I mean, what I want is for these people to be laughed out of the room, like for people not to take them seriously. I mean, I don't know if Vox and what's the other one?
Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. And there's one more, but anyways, BuzzFeed and everybody else, they don't know that just one generation below us, they have lost those people. Those are the PewDiePie people, right? And once they replace us, these whole calling people bigots and, you know, anti-Semitic, all of this PC, I'm seeing, this is why I'm more afraid of Islam and, you know, than these PC culture stuff, even though they're going to do a lot of damage in the short term. I think the next, they're done by the next generation. I'm not sure, but I think they're going to die. This idea, this, the PC culture and everything. I don't know. I'm hopeful, but what do you think?
I mean, I could see us being on the verge of a new, like, free speech movement. I mean, yes. we have people that are really strongly upholding it, even people who agree or who disagree majorly about things. I mean, like Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, they're totally aligned when it comes to free speech, and they both have huge audiences that have a certain overlap, but also have this huge rivalry kind of against each other, right?
Right.
And I could see us being on the verge of that. And yeah, with people who have more moderate ideas and less PC ideas being popular, like PewDiePie, basically what you're kind of saying here, I kind of agree, is Vox is saying, oh, he's shepherding people toward being alt-right or whatever. No, he's shepherding people toward realizing that there are money-hungry journalists out there using PC culture as a way to get more people to read their article.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. the only thing that makes me more a little bit more pessimistic is that this ideology, this PC religion, is very powerful in place in one place where it matters the most, and that's Silicon Valley, right? Mm. And this culture, this one tiny little city, it has an influence on what we can and cannot say on a global fucking level, right?
Yeah.
And even though it might die other places, as long as it has such a powerful influence over there, activism on a global scale is being impacted by what they decide is allowed for us to allow. And this is why I think a lot of people, when they talk about private markets and private companies and them being able to do whatever they want, and like, yeah, that's true if there was competition. The way that these companies are right now in Silicon Valley, when it comes to the level of control they have over what we can say, is more than most governments, right? So yeah. Given that there is no competition, they should be treated like fucking governments. Like, this is a free speech issue.
Yeah. So I actually had this conversation with some people on my Discord. And essentially, do these companies need more regulation? And, you know, usually I try to start from what's the minimal regulation that's needed, and then we kind of build from there rather than the other way around. Yeah, do these things need to be treated like governments? And essentially, do these independent workers, like people like me who like work for themselves but also work for Google at the same time, do we need to unionize in order to have our free speech respected, even though this is a private company? Does it pass a certain threshold? Does our government, or do governments in various countries or wherever these are based, need to say, you know what, once you get this certain amount of power, you have to be treated differently and there's different laws? It's almost like a tax bracket. You know, you go up to a certain population in your company or impact or whatever, and you're treated a little bit differently because of your differential in power.
But
or,
isn't that a little, that's kind of against the whole free market idea?
Yeah, and that's the reason. I think that's why it's so scary for a lot of people.
Well, it's very scary because first of all, I mean, you have this whole idea of, is there a competition or not? And the thing is, there's many different platforms. Facebook targets a lot of ex-Muslims, for instance. They ban them all the time. Twitter doesn't do that to that extent. Patreon's a whole different thing. All of these different companies, they their rules and regulations vary. I mean, they all kicked off Alex Jones, but Twitter kept him on for a little while, and so it really depends.
No, they cooperate, Eddie. They are talking with each other.
Okay, they do whatever they do,
which is anti-competitive.
The thing is that this is not, and I think we've talked about this before. You know, when we talk about free speech legally, the legal right to free speech, that is not impinged in any way. I mean, Alex Jones is still out there spewing whatever he wants to spew.
Yeah.
You know, these Laura Loomer, that lady who was that her who was protesting outside the Twitter office, handcuffed herself to them?
I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So she was, she was protesting, and so she's able to say whatever she wants to too. Like none of their legal rights, their First Amendment rights, are fully intact. So this is not a this is not a question about whether Twitter should allow free speech, because Twitter has absolutely no right and no say in allowing free speech. But it does have a say in whether we're going to give you a platform for your free speech. Yeah. So this is a platforming thing.
It is still a legal issue, maybe not from a free speech perspective, but from a competition perspective. From a
monopoly?
Yeah, but monopoly from perspective. Monopoly? Because they are actively working with each other. And I mean, the fact that like whenever...
That's not a monopoly. That's not a monopoly. Is like, you know, for instance, what Microsoft would do. I mean, that was a monopoly. There was an actual case against them. But this is not something that's happening with these...
No, when companies get together and they do price fixing or do whatever...
They buy each other out and all that.
Yeah. Or do whatever that makes competition, reduce competition, the government does have a case to get involved. And when you see that like all social medias except Twitter start getting rid of somebody to get it at the same time, that shows cooperation. When you see Sargon being removed from Patreon, and then as soon as he goes to Subscribestar, PayPal pulls support from Subscribestar, that shows some level of cooperation. There needs to be this is not fair. This is not free competition. By the way, for whoever is listening to us,
no, but it is free, because they're saying, okay, you know, PayPal doesn't have to do that. They don't have to pull it off. Like, these are companies who have certain audiences. The thing is, the vast majority of people out there, they don't like what he's saying.
You shouldn't be able to. The government has the. You shouldn't be able to cooperate when your cooperation is reducing competition. This is anti-competitive.
No, it's also very anti-free market.
Philly, this is Econ 101. The government, I'm a libertarian, but that doesn't mean that I'm against government getting involved. The government does have to get involved when companies are reducing competition.
If there's a monopoly, I just don't think that's the monopoly.
Let me finish my thought because free market requires government intervening. Because free market requires the government to create the environment where competition is happening, right? So whenever competition is getting, so if you want a free market and companies are doing something where competition is not happening, there is a case for the government to get involved. That's not against the free market. In fact, you need the government for a free market. But go on, sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm saying that happened to Microsoft. I'm not disputing that, you know, the monopoly laws and everything, they should be, those regulations should be there. But I'm just saying that I just don't think that, and by the way, I'm not a fan of deplatforming either. I don't think Alex Jones should have been kicked off of anywhere. I don't think that the Sargon guy should have been kicked off. I don't think any of these guys should be deplatformed by these companies. But I also don't think YouTube should be demonetizing videos with, you know, the tag ex-Muslim in it, which is what YouTube does. But at the same time, I think it's a very dangerous, slippery slope if we start, redefining what it means. Like, if Facebook comes out and says, okay, Instagram's getting big, we're going to buy them out, and they buy them out, and the founders of Instagram willingly sell it to Facebook, I don't think that that's. I think that's very different than, you know, what was going on with in the Microsoft case, for example. So
while we go to before we go to something else, I just want to mention to all our patrons that if you do want to find alternative platforms than Patreon to help us, please stay a little bit. As soon as there is an alternative, we will provide that alternative, but please don't leave us until we find that alternative. We really need you guys. Are you seeing any issues with your Patreon account because of all this mess?
No. And, you know, I've seen some people say, oh, well, the only reason why such and such people are losing any Patreon dollars is because they cultivated a toxic audience and they had Nazis in their audience and stuff. And I don't buy that. But I mean, I think that maybe I've had a couple of people stop, they get off Patreon, people that were, you know, between $1 and $5, just like a handful. It couldn't be more than five.
Right.
But there hasn't been any real impact on my Patreon recently. But I'm a little surprised, but I mean, it's good for me.
But are you going to provide, like, once there's a good competition to Patreon, will you be providing that as an option?
Yeah, if there's good competition, like if there's an actual, reasonable alternative, then I think that's a good thing to do for, the moral conscience of anyone who has that kind of objection. I would want to do that. And I already have, I have PayPal, which people don't quite hate as much as Patreon at the moment. And some people have resorted to doing that already. Right. So
yeah, we have PayPal on secularjudges.com as well. But it's bizarre to me that the video that they saw, that they are referring to attack Sargon, the one video that they picked was exactly the video where he was fighting against Nazis. That's so ironic that the accusation of somebody being alt-right. I mean, whatever you want to say about the language he chose, you could agree or disagree with that, but that was specifically a video where he was attacking alt-right and neo-Nazi people, and he was just using their own language against them. It's so, it just shows that they're so out of touch with the conversation. This, and also like the YouTube Rewind, did you see that it became the most, the most unliked video in the history of YouTube, ended up being a YouTube video. It just shows that these platforms just don't get their own community.
I agree. I mean, I really can't say it any better than you did, especially about with Rewind. They're not on the ground level, and you'd think that it's accessible enough with people like PewDiePie being involved with people who don't have tens of millions or like over 50 million subscribers or something. It's not actually that hard to kind of get the feel of the actual community of YouTube.
Right.
As long as you're not like a preteen, it's pretty easy, because maybe if you're a preteen, you're just going to be watching like Fortnite videos, and you think that Logan Paul, Jake Paul, Lele Pons, and all this kind of like bullshit defines all of YouTube. But if you're an actual adult and can notice basic trends, I think it's really easy to figure out what the core community of YouTube kind of is. And maybe I'm biased because I'm a YouTuber. I do this full time. I don't think it's actually that difficult. I think that really what it has to do with is kind of what you already said. There's this political bias within this certain area of the country, and they're idealists, which want their community to be something which it's not. And so instead of trying to, I mean, they do it to a certain extent, try to regulate it to the point where everyone agrees with them. They also pretend that everyone already agrees with them.
But the thing is that the preteen or whatever, what they're going to want to do is they're very interested in doing the things that people are going to tell them that they shouldn't be doing, especially with this whole online stuff. They notice that this is the thing that is going to get the most reaction out of people. I'm going to go do just that. And they're just going to push the limit. And what TikTok has shown is that it's so easy for a new platform to just start out of nothing and all of a sudden become a competitor to YouTube. I mean, these people should be afraid. I mean, the barriers for people jumping from one platform to another, especially with this hipsterish attitude that I'm going to be somewhere where most people are not, is a threat to them. And I feel like there's something coming, that there's a whole generation of people if the people that are own the platform do not understand them, they will just abandon them like that without even thinking about it. I can't wait for that to be this easy, because it needs to be about the content, not about the content provider, not about the platform itself. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as soon as there is this viable alternative, people thought it was VidMe for a while, I believe. But as soon as there's this viable alternative to YouTube, not only is it going to be beneficial just because of the lack of demonetization and things like that, hopefully, on this new platform, but yeah, if you get on there first, I mean, if I got on a platform that ended up being viable, a viable alternative to YouTube, within the first couple of months of it starting up, I would probably be one of the biggest atheist YouTubers of all time. Right. And so there's a huge incentive for me to do that.
That's right. And you'd be like one of the pioneers, right? I mean,
I'd be one of the pioneers of that. And it wouldn't be because my ideas are new or something like that, just because I came first on the platform.
Maybe we should put Secular Jihadists on TikTok. I don't know if that's going to work.
I think so. They had so I had a question that, you know, there's this thing called gab.com, right? So I read about it after this. Who's that guy? The recent guy who did the shooting? Guy who did the
and they removed the
anti-Semitic, the guy who killed all the Jewish people in the synagogue. So he was apparently on gab.com quite a bit. So is that one? That's one of the alternatives that was getting fairly popular, right?
Yeah,
but, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody there on is a.
But that shows how ridiculous it is, because PayPal, was it PayPal that pulled out of Gab because that guy was on Gab? Gab is like an alternative to Twitter.
Oh yeah, a lot of people pulled out of it.
But that doesn't make sense, because there's also a lot of terrorists are also on Twitter. Why people are not supporting? Like, this is what I'm telling you, man. This is not free. This is not fair and free competition. There's standards.
But it is.
Whoever tries to compare.
Here's why it is. Here's why it is. So what happens is that the Laura Ingraham goes out and says some shitty thing about the victims of the shooting, the school shooting in Florida, right? And then there's this widespread, public pressure for advertisers to pull out of it. The advertisers obviously want to sell to the public. The public who's buying this stuff, they're like, pull out of it, and then they pull out of the show. Right, and that's also free speech and free market at work.
That's not what I'm saying. What the people that pulled out of Gab was not just the advertisers. It was their payment processor. Okay, that's not that. Why is the same standard not? Let me see. Actually, what was it? Gab and PayPal was
because the payment processor. The thing is that
you're getting cut in and out. Is that happening for you?
Yeah, but.
Yeah, I'm not getting
about being boycotted. The payment processors. Yeah. That's a problem. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Is it okay?
Yeah, you're back.
Better?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm saying even the payment
get processors. Get better internet.
Even they are they're under pressure. They're being threatened with boycotts. Because you got to see the majority
of Ali, social media. You should listen to my point before. My point is that when the amount of pressure GoDaddy and PayPal put on Gab is not the same pressure that people put on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, okay? The pressure that they get, these companies get, are just advertisers pulling out, which is fair enough. The pressure people like BitChute, Gab, and Subscribestar are getting is pulling out the services that you need to even run the fucking business. You know what I mean?
Like PayPal, the payment process.
You like Stripe and PayPal and anything. Like, you can't even host, like, whatever you're hosting your data, like, you can't even function without these things, right? If advertisers want to pull out, that's fair game. But I'm just saying the standards of the people, the companies that are coming as competitors to provide a more free speech environment, free environment for people to start, they are not dealing with this. It's not just that these are big companies, so they're hard to compete with. It's more than that. It's just not playing. They're not playing the same game.
Why do you think PayPal would pull out of it?
Well, but because if you look at the Silicon Valley,
what are the reasons?
Let me answer.
Go ahead.
If you look at the Silicon Valley culture, they talk to each other. These CEOs, they talk to each other and they have each other's back. But anyways, go on.
Yeah, but I mean, so if there is a CEO saying, "Listen, I think my conscience is telling you, my friend PayPal CEO, to pull out of this thing because," and the PayPal guy's like, "Wait, we're making shitloads of money from this. Why would we pull out?" Or would he? I mean, there's got to be a reason. I think the reason is
Drew. What do you think?
Well, I'm enjoying the conversation. The thing is that I think that my ideas at this point are too malformed to be able to actually provide any kind of helpful commentary. But I do have to mention my helpful commentary that I can provide is that for the people listening at home that cannot see the screen, the people who are not patrons right now listening in posterity, Ali has done some really great, entertaining work with his eyebrows during this conversation. And Armin's face has been only halfway in the screen. So you know that both of them really care about this. This is awesome. I get a front row seat to this, so I'm happy about it.
In the patron chat, the great Razib Khan is calling me Ali Paul Ryan. He's saying I'm taking the Paul Ryan position on this. So, and that's true. I am kind of like on this kind of thing. I'm Like I agreed with the Citizens United decision of the corporations or people. I so did the ACLU, by the way.
Armin, so, I want to see you on a video, a BuzzFeed video that's, I'm libertarian, but I'm not, fill in the blank. As if they would ever do that.
Okay. All right, guys. So let's do this. Let's move back to.
I wanted to ask him about Buddhism and Hinduism, because this is something that you tackled on your YouTube channel, right?
Yeah.
And this is something that is like apparently sacred for atheists to even most atheists to even touch. So you didn't hold back on things. Something that you know. So when you talk about Islam, you got the left, the regressive left shitting on you, right? When you talk about Christianity, you have the alt-right and people shitting on you, right? Especially even atheist right-wingers that think Christianity is special for some fucking reason. But then when you get, when you shit on Hinduism and Buddhism, now you got some people within the atheist community that were with us from the very beginning that they're like, no, this is the one, this is not even a religion. You don't understand Buddhism. This, you don't know what you're talking about. This is a way of life. It's a philosophy. It's actually very useful. So this is something that, you know, a lot of atheists are very sensitive about when you start attacking, but you didn't hold back on that as well. Do you want to say why you decided to tackle that?
Yeah, because I think that the reasons that we give for criticizing Islam or Christianity, that we think that the truth basically has utility and that we want to believe things that are true and not believe things that are false. Right. And we think that we can live the best, most fulfilled lives when we have as much truth as possible and then we learn how to function within those confines. Yeah, if we actually do think those things, then we shouldn't believe things that are not true. And if something is not true, then there you go. Done. You should have the same attitude toward it. And yeah, I don't understand what
it's that simple. Yeah.
There's a special pleading. And one of the things I talked about in that video where I talk about Eastern religion, I went on vacation to Singapore and I was just like, this will be cool because I wanted to do like religious tourism anyway. I wanted to go to temples and all this kind of stuff. I thought that'd be fun. So I was going to go anyway, just for fun. And I ended up making that video out of it. But yeah, so there's these rose-colored glasses, especially in the West and in kind of more secular circles where people like some kind of alternative medicine type stuff. And even among people who are like Sam Harris fans sometimes, they'll see these Eastern religions. And I think it's largely because they don't really know very much about them, that they're like, oh yeah, well, when's the last time that you heard of a Buddhist, you know, doing something violent? And it's like, I mean, have you read any of the news in Southeast Asia of there being Buddhist violence, like Tibetan, like even like, you know, Tibetan monks doing this and that? And it's
but even if they didn't, it's still bullshit. Even if they didn't. Yeah.
Well, the thing is that people a lot of the time go one step beyond like, oh, it's not true. So people will say, oh, it's not true. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily harmful. And to a certain extent, I agree with like with caveats. But
no,
if there is this, there are ideas that like you're motivated to speak against more so if you can see this harm that's prevalent in your society, like surrounding you. And that's one of the phrases I use, like in the society around you. So I know Christianity and a lot of people around me know Christianity well. We have at least personal experience that motivates us to speak against certain things that are harmful. So that like, that's what we do. We're not raised against or with these religions. And so we never personally seen any of this stuff. But the issue is if it requires personal experience to motivate you to think that this is worth speaking against, or this is worth saying, hey, this isn't true, or criticizing, then I think that is, that's a kind of a messed up priority. I mean, I don't have as much personal experience with Islam being harmful, like in the society around me because of where I grew up. Like I was always in Texas. And, but I still realize that it's a problem globally. I think that's a lack of empathy for people around you.
Exactly. But, and if believing in things that are not true is harmful. Okay. That's, if your belief system is not based on reality, you are at a disadvantage to somebody that their belief system is based on reality. I mean, how many people are killing each other because of palm reading? We don't, but we can, or astrology or whatever, right? Like these are things that we know that is, bullshit, and we tackle it because we want to fight the idea in believing in nonsense. Because, and again, this is something I always say, if you allow believing in harmless nonsense without evidence, you're also allowing belief in harmful nonsense in without evidence. Because the people that start believing in palm reading or in zodiac signs or whatever, or, you know, want to go get their fortune told to them or something in a crystal ball, none of this you could point to, like, well, I can't see what the harm in that is. Well, these are just, if you don't address that, if you let people be this gullible, these are the same people that if you tell them vaccines cause autism, they will believe you, right? So you haven't trained, if you see bullshit, tell people why it's bullshit, because it's like, it's, you're training them to, giving them an effective bullshit radar. So now when somebody tells them that vaccines cause autism, they're trained to be skeptical and think about things. You don't, you know, people are like, oh, I just care about whether the bullshit they believe in is harmful or not. Well, the thing is that if you didn't give them the filter to recognize what's bullshit and what's not, what comes after that, you don't really have much control over which direction it goes, right?
Like, yeah, and that's actually one of the points I make directly in the video is, okay, so this is great and peaceful right now. Let's give you every positive point that someone may posit about Buddhism or whatever. But if your epistemology is such that you'll accept things without evidence, right, because it's instilled in you through dogma, what if someone comes in and decides to kind of get creative with dogma, recreates this? There's a reform movement that goes to the negative. And, you know, in a couple of generations, you have a bunch of Buddhist terrorists. Well, exactly. What happens then? Well, then you have those terrorists have the same epistemology as you. And the epistemology can be monumentally harmful. So the epistemology is not okay. And that's something that I focus on more than the individual beliefs, is the epistemology behind it. And if we fundamentally are criticizing religions because of this faulty epistemology behind it, then it needs to apply to things across the board. Because there's not an exception there, right? Even if this thing is not like as harmful as is being a Wahhabi right now, we know that this is something, this is a vital component to that. And so it still deserves criticism.
You had an example in one of your videos about a napkin religion where it was, am I correct? Like that was interpreted in three different ways. And you were criticizing atheists because I really like that one. Do you want to explain it a little bit? Because I want to let you know, and then I'll let you know how it translates to what we were just talking about.
Yeah. So, well, what I was talking about there was understanding what the true meaning of a religion is, or what a religion truly is. And so imagine there is a religion of the napkin. Someone leaves it in a bar. They just write a note that, I think it's, I can't remember exactly what I thought that it said. But it has a few interpretations. I don't remember the exact message. I wish I did. Off the top of my head, I wrote it. So, you know, I'm the founder of the religion of the napkin. So this is how much people who invent religions have, are invested in their own religions. But so one interpretation was that we should drink as much as possible and have fun, and being drunk is great, awesome, and okay. The other one is, no, you should not drink at all. And it's the same message.
What was the original message that we were interpreting?
Well, that's what I'm trying to remember. I'm going to have to look it up actually on my notes here, because it's kind of important to the point.
So
there's three interpretations while I look for this. So one is that we should drink a lot, drink a ton. One is that you should not drink at all. That's not okay. And one is that you should just drink in absolute moderation based on consequence of your own drinking. It's a personal choice. You're very pro freedom of practice of drinking. And what should we look at? How should we determine what the religion of the napkin is? Should we take one of those interpretations and say, this is the one true interpretation, this is the only one, and if you're interpreting it any other way, then you're wrong? Even if you don't believe in the religion of the napkin, you don't follow it, you still decide to take one interpretation and say, this is the real one. Or if you're trying to describe what the religion of the napkin is, should you describe all three interpretations and say, you know what, maybe we also need to study drinking behavior and see whether or not drinking behavior is affected by this? Because all the other approach is saying this is what the religion really is, and all of those people not drinking because of it, you know, they're not really it. So we don't even have to consider them when describing the religion of the napkin.
So basically, let me reword. Like, there's a verse on this napkin, and you could gives you the option to interpret it in three different ways. Like, one of them is not so harmful, but not so beneficial. One of them is extremely harmful, and one of them is actually good advice, right? And what your criticism to the the napkin religion atheist is that don't say that this worst interpretation is the only thing you could get out of it, right?
Yeah.
My response to that would be, I'm not saying that this is the only interpretation I'm getting. My problem with the napkin is two things. First of all, that third interpretation is a very plausible reading of it, right?
Yeah.
So even though, yes, you could get one or two, the good one and the moderate one, the thing is that it doesn't really make it clear, and that really bad interpretation is definitely plausible reading. Yeah. But my main problem with the napkin religion is that why the fuck are you listening to a fucking napkin? Right?
Right.
That's the main issue, right?
And so people say, oh, you know, well, that's not it. Moderates will say, oh, that's not true Islam. You know, the thing that you're criticizing, forcing women to wear hijabs. Oh, that's not true Islam or whatever. And I say, okay, well, I'm still criticizing Islam because you can demonstrate that there is an effect. There is an A to B there.
Right.
Yes. Even if, I'm not even saying that there's a true interpretation of Islam. There's tons.
Right.
You can demonstrate that the fact that this exists is motivating people to do things that are just not okay.
Right.
It's motivating people to do some things that are cool, you know, fine, whatever, right. Like be it to make zakat or whatever, like give charity.
Actually, zakat is not a good example, but maybe like here's a good, because the zakat example is mostly goes to the people that shouldn't be holding the money. The best example for maybe some in Islam that's something good is that taking care of orphans. Use that example.
That's a good example. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's things that, and people can interpret it a bunch of different ways. People might interpret, like, some people might interpret zakat even as giving to like good, decent charities, or taking care of orphans or whatever. That's cool. Then there's a through line there. It's just that any atheist or anti-theist often says you can get that from elsewhere,
right?
Very obviously. And there are plausible readings that are horrendous, and that you can tell that, yes, people have actually taken those plausible readings and done terrible things with them, sizable numbers of people. So what do we need to do there? Well, maybe we need to rip up the napkin, or
yes,
maybe we need to tell people, hey, don't listen to a fucking napkin.
Yeah, actually, this is such a, I love your example, because this is actually goes into my problem with the reform movement, is right? Because the reformers are saying, like, hey, let's look at this napkin and try to encourage people to get the interpretation that is the best one, right? Like, no, let's tell people to not get advice from a napkin. In fact, you by trying to focus on the interpretation of the napkin that is giving you the best advice, you're actually helping giving legitimacy to people listening to random napkins that they find in the bar, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. And on top of that, I think that there's also an argument of, you know, whenever people get into this minutia of what does this verse mean, what is that verse, it's actually a lot of fun. I enjoy it a lot because, you know, when you read about it, it's a lot of fun having those discussions. But I think the more effective approach is to, even if you don't want to go as far as getting them to reject it, which is what all of us support, but, you know, you can just challenge the idea of infallibility, right? Just say that, okay, you know, you've got this text. Is it because when the demotion from something that is infallible to something, or something that is divinely revealed to divinely inspired, even though it seems like a small demotion, it is a massive demotion, because it allows people to cherry pick. It allows people to sort of download into the scripture. So if you raise people that way, if people are taught to think that this is divinely, and this happened. I mean, we saw this in Judaism. It's like, you know, it was the literal word of God, and then it got demoted to divinely inspired. And
drink is yours. And so you could interpret it that's like, oh, I have a choice to drink. So yeah, like I should drink. Or the choice to drink is yours. And it's saying like, oh, well, the choice to drink is yours.
Like, yeah, you're cursing, like, you're bringing it on yourself. Like,
so, yeah, you're bringing it on yourself. You're hurting yourself. Don't do it. And then there's one that's a somewhat literalist interpretation that's like, I have a choice. I have a choice to drink.
Right.
I should value that choice and fight for that choice for myself and others.
Yeah.
That's such a good example.
So go on, finish what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, so I just wanted to anyone that's curious about that. And the whole point of that section was to say there's no such thing as true Christianity or true Islam or true any other religion. There are just interpretations that people disagree upon of different things. There are literal interpretations. There are metaphorical interpretations. There are things that occur to people maybe more naturally and things that occur to people less naturally. There are things that occur to people who are less and more educated. And I don't think that you can say this is the true interpretation it neglects the actual practice overall.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there.
Yeah, me too.
First thing I wanted to say was that the part of it that I really like is that the choice to drink is yours. And when you say that, we have an exact analog like that in the Quran that's very often quoted by the moderates and the apologists. No. That there is no compulsion in religion.
I knew you were just like,
there's no compulsion. But whenever anybody quotes that, they completely ignore the very next verse.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is Surah 2, verse 256. It completely ignores Surah 2, verse 257, which says, "But if you choose to disbelieve, then your allies are going to be in Tathagata. You know, they're going to be in hell forever." So it's a very passive aggressive kind of way of saying the choice is yours. But but the place I disagreed with you on is when you were talking about the literal and the metaphorical. I think that when people say that, they seem to say it as if it applies to pretty much all of the scripture. Like you can take anything in scripture, you can interpret it any way they want to. But that's not true. So what you're saying may apply to like
some verses
in the Quran, right? In the Quran, I'll tell you there's some things that are clear as day. They're very, very straightforward. There are other things that are a little bit more vague. Including this, you know, that there's more good, there's more harm in alcohol than there is good in it, or the strong drink that's derived from grapes. There's more bad in it than good, and people can interpret that in different ways. And then there are some things that are completely cryptic, like alif lam mim. Like nobody knows what the fuck that means. Like they just say that's something only God knows and nobody else knows. And there are many. Verses like that too. So I think that applies to, and it's the same thing. I think for the Bible and for the Old Testament, New Testament, the Torah, everything. So I think that applies to some places where you can take, and I mentioned this in my book. You know, one example was the four witnesses that you need four male witnesses to be able to witness the act of penetration before you can be charged for adultery. And you know, the whole idea is, I remember when I used to explain it to people when I was religious, was that in what situation would you actually find four male witnesses who'd be able to witness the act of penetration? So the whole idea is that they just don't want you to do it in public. If you're doing it in private,
we should have said that more directly. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. So in my case, I would use that because that was something that was twistable. Yeah. Right. But when it says, you know, when you have other verses that are just really, really clear and straightforward, right? Like, don't eat the flesh of swine, for instance. You know, there's no getting around that. You know, you can't really mess with it or interpret it.
Can I respond to this as well? Because so I agree with Ellie. Like if you want to compare the napkin with like Islam or Christianity, there are some parts that it is true Islam, because there are some parts of the, like, maybe that verse that you mentioned could be put into different ways, but there are some parts of it that, like, for example, the Quran, the idea of non-believers burning in hell is pretty straightforward. Like, you can't really argue with that unless you're really trying to, right? So that is part of true Islam. And another thing that is part of true Islam and also part of the true part of the napkin religion is, whatever, even if you have three different interpretation, you could argue that the napkin itself is part of the napkin religion. It's a true part of the napkin religion, right? Like if you do take out the napkin out, now you don't have the napkin religion. So there is some core that is consistent within all the different branches of this religion, right? Like, which is the fact that we're following this napkin, right? So if we're talking about true Islam,
this is like the best conversation ever. So it's all the napkin thing.
This is one of my favorite things to talk about, actually, this specific subject.
And so when it comes to Islam, for example, even if there's a certain verse that is, you could get different interpretation of it, the fact that you're following the Quran is the true part of the Islam as a religion. And that's criticizable as every Islamic idea that you could possibly want. And also, here's another thing. The napkin, you have three interpretations, but then there's also a fourth interpretation, which is the actual objective truth, which is the story behind who the fuck, like, if you look at, like, Christianity and Islam from a scholarly perspective, or actually maybe the story behind a verse that we will probably never really know. For example, Muhammad, when he asked for four witnesses, was it because he wanted, maybe different interpretation, he actually wanted people to, for you to get four witnesses before you actually come accuse somebody of adultery. Another liberal, moderate interpretation, he's basically trying to say that there's no way you could get somebody to accuse somebody else of adultery. Or maybe reality was that somebody accused his wife of adultery and he was just trying to get out of a very tough situation, right? So the napkin story, you have three interpretations, which is the religious interpretations, but then also the academic, or maybe the real story behind, what was the story behind the person that actually wrote that on a napkin and put it in the bar, which is actually the favorite, which is actually now makes it a more fun way of looking at religion, because now it's detective work and analysis of history and everything. But sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, I try to take overall more a secular religious scholars or a historian's approach to discovering or describing what a religion is. So I like to look at what I can discern, hopefully, to be the original intent or the historical context of this or that. However, I don't necessarily say that the practice which abides by the original intent of the author is a more core version or more true version of the religion itself. Right. And so one thing I wonder is, do you stand by the idea that one of the true tenets, or one of the tenets of true Islam, is the belief in hellfire and its use as a punishment?
No, I would say the true, one of the true tenets of Islam is to follow the Quran, right? Okay. And I'm having a hard time finding out how could somebody read the Quran and not get the idea out of it that non-believers are going to burn in hell. But I'm trying to come up with such an inclusive definition right, to even allow for that. But the whole idea of just following the Quran is already problematic enough for me to be able to point at that and be like, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. Even if you want to come up with such gymnastic arguments to get out of verses like that, right? What I would say is that it's just, if you come up with an interpretation, like, there are some verses that you could play gymnastics easier with than some other verses. And the idea of unbelievers not going to hell is a very difficult, you have to
unbelievers
flexible.
Going to hell. Other verse. It says, you know, those who reject this. Yeah. For them, there is a doom, there is a hellfire.
It's such a big theme of part of the Quran that's trying to suggest.
There are hundreds of times.
To try to suggest that it doesn't say that, you have to be very good at gymnastics, basically. That's what I'm saying.
So if there were such a people group that said that they said that they were Muslim, but they didn't necessarily say that they followed the Quran, but they still insisted that they were Muslim. Mm. Then would you consider them like true Muslims or truly Islamic?
So I would. Okay. Do they think that the Quran is the word of God?
Let's say no, because they don't follow it.
Well, I mean, most Muslims don't follow it, even though they do say it's the word of God.
Yeah.
So, but these people are going as far as saying that it's not even the word of God.
Right.
Yeah, they're not.
But they still say that they're Muslim, though.
They're not Muslim. They're.
I would consider them Muslim. No, I wouldn't consider them adherent to Islam,
this is something.
But I don't think most Muslims are adherent to Islam.
This is something.
But I would still.
This is something me and Ali disagree with a lot.
Yeah. My whole, and this, I think it goes to the idea that these words, the way that Ari think about this is going to be different from the way Armin thinks about this. So this shows that these things evolve and different people think about them differently. For me, there is the Shahada, the declaration when you convert, basically take a shower, you say, La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, which means that there's no God but God, Muhammad is his messenger. So for me, those are two fundamentals. As long as you say that, and most people who say that, they haven't read the Quran, they don't know what's in it. Even most people who have been Muslim all their lives, they don't know what's in the Quran, they've never read it, they've never understood it, especially with translations. The vast majority of them don't even know Arabic. So even though it is, and they will believe, they will tell you that, you know, you have to believe that the Quran is a word of God, and they may not act on it, but I don't think that that's... And if someone comes up to me and says, I'm Muslim, but I think that the Quran was divinely inspired, but Muhammad wrote it. And I've met a lot of Muslims like that.
No, but Ali, when it comes to your criticism of my definition, you are contradicting yourself, because
I'm not criticizing your definition. I think that that is a legitimate definition.
My point is that a lot of people say, well, a lot of Muslims don't follow the Quran. But my definition of a Muslim acknowledges that. Because in my definition of a Muslim, somebody is a Muslim if they acknowledge that this is the direct word of God, even if they don't follow it, even if they've never read it. That acknowledgement is part of the definition. And a lot of people are like, well, why wouldn't you follow it if you think it's the word of God? I don't know. That's what most people are like, okay? Most people think this is the word of God. Most people think that, you know, but they don't read it. They don't follow it. That's how it is. But that, if you take that...
If this was all rational, you wouldn't have religious people.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But the problem is that if you take that, I mean, definitions have to be useful, okay? When you look at definitions, first of all, they need to be useful. There's two things you look at. How it's being used and how useful is the definition. With regards to how it is changing, well, yes, it might be changing, and you could use it differently once it's changed. But if you look at most Muslims, the vast majority of Muslims, if somebody says, I'm not saying this is the only factor, okay? I'm not making the, you know, argument by popularity, let me finish my point. Because the argument by popularity does apply to definitions, because definitions are based on how people use words. So the popularity matters. The vast majority of Muslims do not consider somebody Muslims if they don't think the Quran is a direct word of God. So that is important part of the definition when it comes to popularity. And another argument I have is when it comes to the usefulness of a definition, because if you take the belief in the Quran as a word of God out of it, it becomes such an empty shell that is absolutely nothing. When you say, I believe in Allah and Muhammad as his prophet, without the Quran, those are just names and they don't represent anything. Yeah, and that it becomes an empty shell, and when a word could mean anything, then it means nothing at all. And this is more, a lot of people are like, oh, that's just semantics. No, this is important, because if we don't know what we're talking about, how could we even criticize something if we can't even communicate?
Yeah, I'm going to respond to that really, really briefly, and then we'll go to you, Drew. Is that I think that, you know, when you're talking about the usefulness and the use, both of those, in terms of communications, it really depends on which time you are. The time that we are in right now, right? It is one of the uses, one of the things, the things that's useful, is to have a something that describes reality and is inclusive of reality. And the reality right now is that there are a lot of young Muslims that are living not only in the West, but across the Muslim world, who, especially the internet generation, who have seen the Quran with a lot more transparency than the generations before them. And many of them are saying, they're like, okay, I'm Muslim. I think that Muhammad wrote the Quran, but I think that he was, interpreting what God's words were. But they don't think that it's a literal word of God.
I do need to respond to what you're saying.
Let me finish.
So
I think that, and it also goes into the distinction between the Islam and Muslims. I think when you talk about Islam and what it is, I think you can use the Quran as a central element of what makes it, because the Quran is Islam. That's basically what it is. But when you're talking about Muslim, and there are people who just identify as Muslims, it's almost like, you know, they're born into Muslim families. They're like, I'm a Muslim, birth identity. I think the definition of Muslim has changed. Even though these definitions, they do have to have uses, they do have to be useful, these definitions do evolve as well. And I think this is just something where we just disagree.
I think you're overestimating the number of so-called Muslims that think that you could not believe in the Quran as the word of God and still be Muslim, even though it's rising. And what I think is important, I mean, when it comes, other than my two other arguments, here's the third one, is that these people that don't think the Quran is the word of God, the only thing that when it comes to usefulness of our movement and what we're trying to do is that I suggest to them to call, if they want to keep the word Muslim, to call themselves cultural Muslims rather than just Muslims. This is a word that people are familiar with and we use it all the time when it comes to cultural Christians.
Yeah, so a cultural Muslim is a kind of Muslim. Would you agree with that?
No, it's not. It's very important.
Then why would you Isn't cultural Muslim a misnomer too then? Can I finish my thought?
Because when we use the word cultural Christian, we understand that this is basically not a Christian. They are not, they're just practicing a certain culture, but they don't actually believe in it. I really think it's important for somebody that wants to keep the culture and but doesn't believe in certain things to keep the cultural part as part of what they call themselves, especially because this really does hurt the ex-Muslim movement. If we people are abandoning the ideology and you're still call, I do want, and still calling themselves Muslims, basically this inflates their numbers and reduces ours. I think if you're a user,
but that shouldn't be a concern when we're defining whether it's helping us or not. It is important
because if we're talking about changing definitions, the usefulness of it is part of the discussion. If you used to believe that the Quran is the word of God and now you don't believe that the Quran is the word of God, you're an ex-Muslim now and you're part of our community now.
I just think when you're saying cultural Muslim or cultural Christian, you know, if cultural Muslim is not really a Muslim, then even that is a misnomer. I think that.
No, anyway, I think it's a, go ahead.
Yeah, let's just, because we talked about this last time too, so I think that we both have made our points.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more advanced than the last time we talked about it, actually, because I think this is better.
It's all because we have the positive influence of the napkin.
Yeah, that's it. Comes down to that. So, do you have anything else to say on this?
I wanted to ask a question.
I'll just weigh in and basically say that the way that I look at religion in general is an infinitely malleable and ever evolving system of belief, which is essentially it's infinitely classifiable, and because of that, it must be described by how people describe it.
Sounds
a little odd. So, well, I do think that an important part of the conversation is how people use the words, because, like, for me, technically, I'm an agnostic. I'm not a philosophical atheist. I'm not a hard atheist. But colloquially, I don't call myself an agnostic because no one understands my position when I say that. And so colloquially, like, I use the word atheist because of the weight that it carries in society or in our culture right now. And it's most useful for me. So that's the reason why I use it. And I think that needs to be taken into defining what atheism is. It's also a term that can be used by people who are philosophical agnostics to denote a certain ideas, like in a colloquial sense. So I think that it contributes to the weakness and demonstrates the weakness of religion, that it's infinitely, and I guess not necessarily the weakness, but the lack of sacredness or the lack of anything special within religion, that it's just as infinitely classifiable, malleable, and ever evolving as any other ideology that's ever existed throughout all time. It's nothing special because it acts in no way differently than a political ideology or any other divinely inspired ideology. And so I think that pointing out how obviously human made and broken any given religion is in all its different forms, and saying there is no true version, like, just period, it actually demonstrates the weakness of religion, or at least the weakness of the argument that there is a certain religion that's divinely inspired or has any divine element to it at all.
Yeah. So I wanted to move on from this because we have about
two things. I guess. First of all, Muscal I was asking what do you think of because you mentioned agnostic atheist. Muscal is asking what do you think of the term humanist?
Yeah. I have no qualms about the term humanist, and when it's useful to me, you know, I'll use it to describe myself. And I could see it being particularly useful in the future, and a lot of people find it useful at the moment. I mean, one of my best friends, a guy on YouTube and Twitter, Objectively Dan, who has a show called Truth Wanted with the atheist community of Austin. I mean, he calls himself a humanist, definitely, and there are a lot of people, especially the atheist community of Austin, that do. And I get that. I mean, I think Seth Andrews is very big about that too. I've used secular humanist to describe myself, like when I've been at work or something like that. Because a lot of the time people will see atheist as like, oh, you're stating that you're against something, but what do you actually believe? So someone actually asked me, like, what do you actually believe? And they want a label for it. What are you kind of thing? Then that's fine. You know, that will do. And if it ends up having more utility than atheist, in many other contexts, then I feel like I would be calling myself a humanist over that. It just depends on the utility at the time, essentially, for me.
I prefer atheist because humanism is not demonized. Atheism is. So that's what we need to normalize.
Yeah, like I'm fine with using both, but one of the reasons why I do use atheist is you guys said at the beginning, like, oh, you know, I think Ali said that my content is different than what you might expect from an atheist YouTuber. And one of the reasons why I consider myself an atheist YouTuber and I espouse that term is because I want to redefine what it actually means to be an atheist YouTuber. And a lot of people have told me, oh, you're not a true atheist YouTuber because you're not a fucking asshole. It's like, so you have a definition that is not malleable, and that excludes everyone.
Call them anti-atheist bigots when they say
yeah. And so it's just like you have this like no true Scotsman definition that excludes people that you don't like or doesn't fall into your bias. And so I'm trying to redefine that, and so I agree with Armin, it's demonized, and most of the time people don't assume I'm an atheist, and I think it's hilarious. And so saying, oh yeah, I'm an atheist, makes it to where other people who maybe have a less nuanced idea of what atheist means, and they really hold to it, and they say, I'm an atheist, maybe they'll be like, remember that like clean cut soy boy that I met? Yeah, he said that he was an atheist, and I didn't really think that he was an ass, and he wasn't a neckbeard or something like that. So maybe this guy that I'm meeting now isn't like inhuman. Maybe he's okay too. Maybe I should actually give him a chance.
Right. No, I like using that word in a lot of contexts. When people ask me how would I describe myself, I'll usually say atheist. There are other times, for instance, if there's a talk I'm doing, and you know, I want to widen the audience and I want them to come in, so I'll make the topic something relating to secular or something relating to humanism. But generally, if people ask, I always, because I want to humanize that. I want people to look at me like, oh, he's such a nice guy. He's a good guy. Hopefully, I'm a nice guy, and they associate that with atheists. But yeah. So I wanted to. We only have, I think we have about 10 minutes left. So I wanted to get to a couple of patron questions.
But but before we do that, he also wanted to ask us something, didn't you?
The thing I wanted to bring up was what you thought about the napkin analogy.
Oh, really?
We talked about it,
And I wanted to talk about what you thought like true Islam is, or if you had an idea of true Islam.
Oh, so we brought it up before you...
And I'm glad you did, because I thought that maybe we had a disagreement about it. And I thought it would just at least be interesting to talk about. I'm satisfied with our conversation about that. So I'm all good. If I come up with something to totally stump you, you know, I'll butt in. Sorry, patrons, but I'll go ahead and do that. I'll deplatform Armin entirely, and I'll have to be the new host.
Monopoly. But okay, so I wanted to ask you actually about one. And there's so many different videos I bookmarked of yours that I want to talk to you about, but I'm just going to get to one of them right now. And that is, you have a video called My Personal Experience with God as an Atheist.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought this is probably one of your most powerful videos that I've seen, because in this, you actually go on to talk about how how you thought about God, how you believed, how you responded to criticism of your religion when you were religious. And I think that that has so many parallels for many Muslims who would listen to, and pretty much anybody who's a strong believer in any religion, so those insights that you have about how deeply you believed and how you processed, you know, the conversations like this when you were on the other side of it as a believer, and how you listened to them. How has that influenced the way that you choose to communicate? Because, you know, you said that you're maybe not as firebrand, and you tend to. You get the question, right?
Well, so. It's kind of the same thing as we talked about earlier. I could criticize Islam all day long, but one of the ways that I get more, I'm seen as more legitimate or get more attention for the criticisms of Islam that I have is to also speak against anti-Muslim bigotry. So one of the ways that I can get more attention to the criticism of religion in general, or of dogma, or of Christianity, or whatever that I'm criticizing, is to reach out and say, yeah, more compassion is needed on this. And we can speak against these ideas and still be friends. And I, you know, personally don't have something against the people that believe differently than me in such and such a way. Like, I don't think of them as any less human or less deserving of understanding compassion as me. So in a way, just like I talked about before, that is both something that allows me to get one of my goals done and accomplished faster, but it's also not necessarily a caveat, because I really do think those things. I really do think there does need to be more compassion on the subject. And that doesn't mean that there can't be firebrands. And I think there's a time and place for that. Obviously, if I thought that there was no place for firebrands, that I probably wouldn't be a fan of Armin Navabi. Oh. And and I am. So that demonstrates that. But for me, this is the way that I find that I can get the most work done. Great. And now with that video specifically, I'm glad that you bring that up for this question, because at the beginning, and if you are getting into atheist YouTube, you realize a lot of it has to do with fallacies. It has to do with teaching you how to reason more formally. It teaches you about just basic critical thinking skills that everyone needs to know, thinking like a scientist, things like that. And what I realize is that is actually really unappealing for a huge number of people. And even if it's not unappealing, it's just totally boring for a lot of people.
It's very cerebral.
Yeah, it's right. Cerebral.
Whereas people religious process it more emotionally and more sentimentally. I mean, this is when we get into the logic and reason stuff. It's compelling, but it's very cerebral.
Mm. Yeah. Actually, hold on just a second. Sorry, guys. I have my wife knocking on the front door. It looks like I locked the door. So I will be back in less than 30 seconds. Sorry, guys.
Sure. No, sure.
No worries. She should get a key.
Yeah.
Yeah, why does we should ask him? Why doesn't your wife have a key?
He'll be back.
No, I'm just kidding. We should make it find a way to make teaching logical fallacies more fun. Actually, there's a book that here. While people are waiting, if you want to buy a gift for Christmas, how to do it for your for kids. This is a really nice book. This makes learning about logical fallacies a lot more fun. Buy this for Christmas for whoever.
So I was just going to say that if you want to take something really cerebral like the logical fallacies and all of that, and you want to make it more interesting in that when people process it, they process it at a more emotional level, not just that. If you use humor, if you use cartoons, if you use animations, things like that, I think that that stuff really, really resonates with people. It makes everything a lot more fun.
Exactly. And I'm back, by the way, for everybody that's listening. But yeah. So
we're talking about how...
Actually, for everybody that is listening that didn't have a visual, what I showed Ali was a book called An Illustrated Book of Bad Arguments by Ali Al-Musawi. And it basically goes over all logical fallacies in a very fun, with cartoons and animals, in a very fun way, if you want to check it out. Anyways.
Go on. So... The device that I chose to use, especially in that video, and that I use more and more, and that I use in talking about my personal experience in like that video about liberals and Islam is narrative. And it's even beyond that, it's personal narrative, it's personal experience. So yeah. We always talk about how anecdotes aren't data. Yes, that's true, but they are incredibly effective vehicles for convincing people of things. And that's why anecdotes get propagated so much more than solid data that's been just meticulously collected. So if you can share a story that reflects the data, and you say, the reason why I think this is because of the data, but this is the way that I came to realize that. And this is the way that I realized my personal experience is valid in this way. My personal experience of the data is this. And this is my fundamental epistemology, and not the personal experience, but the data. Then that tends to convince more people. And
you can transform the data. You can change the data over time. If your stories are as powerful, and we've talked about this so many times, like with I always give the example of Philadelphia, like, you know, when the movie Philadelphia, that, you know, when we were people talking about gay rights or all these op-ed exchanges, and everybody's having this intellectual discussion about it, and then this movie came out, which is fiction. It's a fictional story of just one guy and his experience about it, and that had a massive impact, and it changed a lot of minds because it reached people at a different level.
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing is, like, with, if I'm trying to illustrate a point, like, you can be critical of Islam while still being okay with Muslims, or, you know, being compassionate toward Muslims. You can say that and say, yes, it can be done. It can be done. Obviously, these are two fundamentally different things, different concepts. You can treat things in such a way. This is reality. You can say that all you want and make logical arguments for it all you want. But people who are convinced by emotion about the notions you're trying to convince them out of have a really hard time grasping onto that, because they have this non-cerebral grasp on their ideas. So if you can essentially say, okay, this is the argument for this, and just let me give you an example. This is not, I don't believe it because of my personal experience, but an example of this is a personal experience. Here you go. It's basically like, look at the things that I've been able to do, and show them the caveats, in quotes, in my videos, where I do afford dignity to Muslims, and I do show compassion toward them. And I say, and I still criticize Islam. What do you think of me then? And people are a whole lot less likely to say, oh yeah, well, you're full of shit, because I've demonstrated something. I've told them a story. I've shown them a narrative. And it's a whole lot harder to spit in the face of a narrative than it is with hard reasoning or great sourced analytical scientific data. I don't know why exactly. I think it's fundamental to human psychology, but that seems to be the nature of things. And if you want to make a convincing argument or video, that's kind of what you have to do.
So anecdotes are very powerful, and I guess it's important for people that want to use anecdotes to make sure that they have the it's based on good data, and they're just using the anecdotes to communicate that data. And also they have to mention that there is data for the anecdote that I'm using. But then again, given that it's so powerful, it could also be used for, you know, for misleading people, not just also informing people.
But again, and that's the way that narratives often get used, because they're entirely divorced from data. Right. And then there's an approach that's not optimal, where people only use data to try to convince. And the reality is that one is super convincing and doesn't convey any truth, and one conveys truth but is not convincing. So what I propose is just this inexorable marrying of the two, in order to be able to have a broader audience, but then also convince people of truth.
Yeah, it reminds me of when they had the primary debates, and Donald Trump told that story about that kid he knew who was a great kid, and then he went and he got vaccinated, and then he came back, and then that just fed into, I was like, oh, that is so damaging, because clearly it's complete bullshit, and it's an anecdote, but it's going to change the way that a lot of people think.
This was my thinking behind starting Atheist Republic voicemails, all right? Because you could say, like, hey, atheists from around the world, this is how they're feeling, or you could just listen to them tell you their stories, right?
So stories, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Drew, man, we have to have you back on here again. And
what are you going to do next? What are you planning for future?
Well, right now I'm moving. And so I've been super, super swamped. It's been a crazy busy past couple of weeks. So I'm not totally sure what my next few videos are. I have an idea of, and you know, it's exclusive for people who listen to Secular Jihadists. And I'm thinking about talking about the idea, and there's some people out there who have the idea that Sam Harris is proposing a secular religion. And I want to look at the idea of a secular religion, or like a non-theistic, attempting to be non-dogmatic type of quote unquote religion, a more Durkheimian sense of religion than the
colloquial sense. Love that.
So that's interesting. And also, like, is Sam Harris, you know, actually trying to do that? Should this actually come about? And then I also want to, this will take a lot of research. I don't know how soon this will be, but I want to look at like the arguments, for essentially take, Majid Nawaz's positions and take Armin's positions or any non-reformist positions and put them in one video and try to present it clearly and as neutrally as I possibly can.
Oh, that would be great.
So I think that'd be interesting. And I want some people who are, not Muslim, not ex-Muslim, and not British, who maybe are hearing these conversations more, to hear this conversation, because it's applicable to everyone. I want some Americans, I want some Canadians, I want people all over the world to be able to hear this, and hopefully I have a broad enough audience now that I can break the news that, hey, this is kind of a big deal, and we should be talking about this.
Yeah.
For the first, I can't wait for the second video. I'm going to be sharing the shit out of that one. But for the first video, have you heard about the history of the Temples for Humanity?
I don't think so.
So for the first video, look that up. Look into the history of that. There's this one guy that tried to do that, got some popularity. I don't know what happened to him. This was like way back, but there are some places, especially I think in Brazil, they're very popular. They have they celebrate humanism, but they actually have temples. And they call Temples for Humanity. And what he tried to do, he basically tried to take religion, take all the superstition out of it, keep the ritual, keep the practices, and celebrate real things. And just sort of like, well, religion is. So look into what he did and see if you want to include that history in your video.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's a really good tip, because that allows me to put some more narrative in the video, which is. Makes it much more interesting.
Yeah.
So, last question. This is going to be a patron question, because, you know, we had a handful of them, but we didn't really get to most of them. But I thought this was a really good one, because it's relevant to what we were talking about earlier. The Buddhaman is asking, what do you think about Lawrence Krauss's argument that while Islam may be a bigger problem in the world in general, in the U.S., Christianity is a bigger problem? So he tends to focus on that.
Like I said, I'm not trying to dictate what people or control what people are focusing on in their activism. I largely look at, well, are you going to be more effective in one realm inherently because of your knowledge and because of your demographic or whatever? Are you going to be more effective in this realm or in this realm or this realm? And that's the argument that I would use in trying to convince someone to be active in whatever.
Right.
Not like whether or not you want to, or whether this is a bigger problem. It'd be more their effectiveness. So I think that if Lawrence Krauss had the argument that he can be more effective in trying to dismantle Christianity, then he would have a great basis for focusing his activism there. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he thinks that is kind of an argument for, yeah, well, he has greater ability to actually do that, and maybe where he grew up and his innate knowledge, it lends itself to being a better activist against Christianity rather than Islam. And the position that I'm in, I don't think is that way. And that's not why I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, whatever reason you have, that as long as you're an activist and fighting bad ideas, you're already doing more than most people, right? Like if somebody is fighting, the example I give is like if you have somebody fighting against abuse against dogs, you don't go to them and say like, why dogs? Why you don't care about cats? Like,
there's always going to be a bigger problem. Always going to be something bigger.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, and she might have different reasons. She might know more about dogs than cats. She might care about dogs more than cats. Maybe she lost something happened to her dog when she was a child, right? Maybe, you know, there's so many different reasons, and whatever reasons that she has, maybe she just feels more passionate about dogs, right? The fact is that she is helping, she's doing, what we have to fight is apathy, right? The fact is that she there's a problem, and she's caring about it. Now, you know, you don't also go to skin doctors and be like, why did you become a skin doctor? Don't you think cancer is a bigger problem? Like what?
Well, yeah. One of my favorite quotes comes from someone you might know. You don't go into a cancer, you know, kind of cancer relief conference or fund or whatever and say, hey, what about AIDS? You might know who said that, but exactly. The whataboutism is ridiculous. I mean, anytime I talk about Christianity, they're like, oh, you don't talk about Islam enough. Why are you talking about Islam? You wouldn't talk about Islam. And I talk about Islam and they're like, oh, well, you need to talk about Christianity. Why are we talking about
it? I know that's exactly what
this is what I say. Like, if I talk about Islam, people say like, not just Islam, all religions. And I'm like, well, why just religions? Why not all dogma? And they're like, okay, all dogma.
What about communism?
And
I'm like, what about Nazism?
Hold on. So they say like, why not all dogma? Why are you focusing on religion? They're like, okay, fine, all dogma. Like, well, why just dogma? Why not just all bad ideas? I'm like, okay, fine, all bad ideas. I'm like, why just bad ideas? Why not bad everything? I'm like, okay, anything that is bad is bad. Okay, is that general enough for you now? Like, are we covering everything?
This is the advice. Well, first of all, then you have people like I've had come in and say, well, I'm a nihilist. What about everything? You should be fighting against that. The thing that I have to say to the people who endlessly waffle is how I see it and are urging activists to fight against this or that or everything or whatever. Why don't you do it?
Yeah. Right.
Where's your channel? Where's your podcast? Where's your book? Where's your blog?
Yeah.
If it's not there, you have no room to speak. So I have people saying that I don't talk about climate change enough, or I don't talk about fascism, or people want me to shit on capitalism or whatever. And I say, okay, you think that these things are things that need to be talked about. You've never even tried to get where I am with my platform. I did it. You could probably get somewhere with it. Fucking do it and stop complaining. That's the solution to whataboutism, is people to get off their ass and actually make a platform for themselves and talk about the things that they want to talk about.
Exactly. Right. And I think that's a great place to conclude this too. So
where can people find you? Yeah.
People can find me at Genetically Modified Skeptic on YouTube. I am at @GM_skeptic on Twitter, GM Skeptic on Facebook. I also have a Discord, which if you go to the links of, or you go to the descriptions of any of my videos, then you can be linked to my Discord there. And I get on voice chat at least once a week and talk with people there.
I thought Discord was just for gaming. No?
It's growing. And it's a pretty big deal. I mean, I'm not like a huge gamer or anything, and that's not what I use it for. It's to have a little bit deeper of interaction with fans. A lot of YouTubers have this, and as long as you can control it the right way and not let it devolve into shit, right, then it's a great way to.
But it started from the gaming community, right? That's how it started.
It was a tool for gamers essentially, but you can. There's a lot of customization there. Right. So
I like how these things are popping up. Hopefully, they create competition against all these other platforms.
Almost everyone on Discord is young, by the way. So if you're trying to cultivate a younger audience, Discord is the way to do it. You can hit me up and we can talk about Discord. Yeah, and
I didn't even know about it. I'm gonna check it out now. We need to get
on Discord. Okay, I'll hit you up
there. All right. Okay. So all of the patrons, Budiman, Razib, Muscal, like everybody out there, thank you very much for joining us. Sean.
He's saying fantastic conversation, guys. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I mean, the time just whizzed by, and I'm just thinking, I have like 3 or 4 tabs open here that I wanted to talk to you about, and I think we're just going to have you in. I feel like I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. So,
well, I would absolutely love to come back on. Yeah, it went by really, really quickly, and usually I do like an hour and a half or whatever on podcasts, and this felt like it. I mean, this is longer than that, and felt way too short. So yeah, I would absolutely love to do a part two. That is fine with me.
Awesome. Yeah, that's amazing. So anyway, we're gonna say bye bye. Thanks everybody for joining us, and we're gonna see you next time.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.